This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Jules Lobel about a class action suit at Pelican Bay Solitary Confinement.
State efforts to destroy that lawsuit fail, as the Center for Constitutional Rights will now take on solitary confinement in the entire state of California.
Architects concerned with social responsibility have called for a moratorium on designing solitary confinement and death chambers.
They see death chambers and solitary confinement as major human rights violations. They don't think anyone should participate in these violations of rights.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, President Obama has gone before Congress to get authorization to use military force against ISIS. But I understood that he was already fighting ISIS. What is this about?
It does seem bizarre, Heidi. I mean, in one way, perhaps it's going to expand his authority, and we'll get into some of the details. In another way, I guess he feels better having Congress on his side against ISIS. It may also be that now that he has Republicans on both sides, that he has an easier time of getting more authority to go to war. I think that's actually the biggest factor. The Democrats might give him a little harder time. Not much harder, but a little harder. Let me give a couple of the technical details. It's called the authorization to use military force. And of course, under our Constitution, the Congress is supposed to approve the use of military force. In fact, of course, this president, like every other one, seems to ignore that. As people recall, he went to war against Libya without such a use of authority from Congress. And he's been fighting against ISIS for 5-6 months already. Although his claim is that he's fighting against ISIS because it fits an old authorization to use military force, the one from 2001, which was originally authorized to go after the people who were involved in the attacks of 9/11. That's been infinitely expanded so far that not only is the president bombing ISIS, but he's using drones in Yemen, he's using them in Somalia, he's all over the world with the 2001. So you can see it has these broad uses of force that the president is authorized to use by Congress. It reminds us, Heidi, of course, as we've talked about, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was passed to give the president authority to go into Vietnam and fight against the Vietnamese. But it was so broadly stated that it went on forever, and it expanded the war to 500,000 U.S. troops. And in addition, of course, in this case, in the case of Gulf of Tonkin, it was based on a false set of facts having to do with an attack by the North Vietnamese, supposed attack in the waters. But in any case, these are bad examples, because what happens is you give the presidents these kind of authority and they basically expand them to world war. And what's amazing to me here is you have the 2001 authorization to use military force, which has already been expanded, and they're not planning to end that one. They're planning to leave that on the books, even if they get this new authorization to use military force from 2015. So he's going to have both. And then he says he doesn't even need it. Even if Congress turns him down, he says, I still have the old one. So the whole thing is just a charade for wide war.
And I imagine, Michael, that it's in response to heightened media coverage of beheadings and high-profile actions, which, as we've seen over the years in this country and abroad, often result in hastily passed legislation to placate public fears.
You know, I think that's a good point, that it may not just be that he has Republicans on both sides, but in fact, as the ISIS propaganda and videos come out, people are saying, well, what's the president doing? And so now he's saying, well, look, I'm going to Congress, I'm going to get this authorization to use military force, but he's going to get a very broad authorization to use military force. Now, there's three or four points in it that I want to mention because they're so shocking and surprising. Let's just look at the scenario here. The Democrats want to put some limits on it, not very many, but some, on this use of force. The Republicans want an ever-expansive use of force. Not much real difference between them, but some of the details. The first one comes up in what's called the Sunset Clause. And we've talked about Sunset Clauses here with regard to the Patriot Act, etc. When liberals want to vote for something bad, but they want to feel better about it, they say, oh, we're going to put a Sunset Clause in. That means that in 2, 3, 4 years, whatever the sunset provision is, the law will end by itself, and it won't be renewed automatically. Well, we know what happened with the Patriot Act, which we predicted at the time, was a lot of liberals voted for the Patriot Act because it had a sunset clause. That was their excuse. Oh, we'll tell our liberal constituents it's going to set in 4 years. And of course, it did set, but of course, before it set, Congress went and renewed it for another 4 or 10 or whatever number of years. So this one has a 3-year sunset clause. Let's think about that. One, they can renew it always. But secondly, even if it sets in 3 years, the president, and it won't be Obama anymore, just goes back to the 2001 authorization right. to use military force, which has no sunset. So essentially, the sunset clause is meaningless for lots of reasons, except it gives liberals cover. And for that reason, I oppose the sunset clause, because I don't want liberals having cover. They ought to vote for what they understand they're voting for, which is indefinite war against the world. So that's one very bad provision. A second one, and a big struggle is going on, or I don't know if it's big, a struggle of some sort, at least in the press around these guys, is the use of ground forces. How are we going to limit the use of ground forces? Initially, I think we were told there won't be any ground forces used against ISIS or whatever, we'll bomb them. Now, of course, they're seeing that to defeat ISIS, they believe they have to use ground forces. So what does this authorization to use military force say, the new proposed one? This does not authorize the use of United States armed forces in, and here's the key word, enduring offensive ground combat operations. The word is enduring offensive ground combat operations.
Right. And what does that mean? That means a long term, something short of a long. Exactly.
1 year, 2 year, 5 years, right. 10 years. What's right. enduring? Forever?
Right. It's overbroad and vaguely drafted.
So, meaningless. They can use, right. basically, the president is authorized to use ground forces forever.
Right.
So again, the Democrats are going to be able to say to their constituents, or maybe a few Republicans who are a little isolationist here, will say, it doesn't say we gave them authority forever. So it's a complete...
It's not in perpetuity.
So it's BS. That's number two. A third part of the law says it allows war to be made on associated persons or forces. That means individuals and organizations associated in some way with ISIL or ISIS, the Islamic State. And the problem is that's like saying war can be made on anybody. And we know that from experience, because in the 2001 AUMF, it also uses the term, or has been interpreted to be, you can make war on associated forces of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Well, now under the U.S. definition, the government definition, that's everybody. That's the people in Somalia, that's the people in Yemen, that's the people in Mali, that's everywhere. So it's a meaningless restriction, associated forces. That's number three. And number four, and this is really striking, really, if you're thinking about the U.S. in perpetual war, the act, the new proposed authorization to use military force of 2015, has no geographical limitations. That means if they think there's an ISIS guy living next door, they
in
can...
In the U.S. of A.
The U.S., anywhere in the world, they can get that guy, whether through joint special operations, drone him, whatever they want to do. So war on the world is not a fantasy from this act. It's not a fantasy of mine. And just remember this as we go on. And there was a Times article a few days ago that talks about the so-called spread of ISIS, almost playing into this new authorization to use military force, saying there's ISIS groups in Saudi Arabia, in Yemen, Algeria. And so now the U.S. under this act can make war everywhere. So what we have now is an authorization, if it passes, that allows the president to make more war around the world and kill thousands and thousands of more Muslims. Instead of this, of course, we should have less war, no war. We should probably have the Congress impeaching the president for already going way beyond the war authorization he's had. Sadly, for me, the U.S. as an imperial power has been almost impossible to restrain. You and I know this, Heidi, since our days as Vietnam activists and beyond, the U.S. has been at constant war. So we're watching a charade going on in Congress, in the media, the thousands of words, what's going to happen with the AUMF. It doesn't make any difference. In a sense, We're watching a bloody charade that will continue for a very long time.
And Michael, we're seeing it play out on the local level. In New York, the police department recently announced that they would be creating a new unit, I believe, an anti-terrorism unit that initially the commissioner said would be used to include protesters and they would be heavily armed. There was fallout from that, and he retracted the protest component of it, tried to play it down. But I think this is not unrelated, that when you have legislation like this passing on a federal level, it trickles down to local departments as justification for ramping up their own militarized police forces.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, I think what you're seeing is there, you know, there's a terrorist hiding behind every bush in the world, and therefore we've gotten this, perhaps they'll pass this new AUMF, and then they're going to say, well, why isn't that true in the United States? And they'll use it in that way as well. And so I think there's a direct relation. I remember during the Vietnam War period, there was a great quote by Johnson. When he was being criticized so heavily for Vietnam, he said, well, to see that we're not really violating human rights in Vietnam, look at what we're doing at home, and what we do at home, we also do abroad. And the poster had Johnson's words on it, and a picture of the early days of the SWAT team, those guys, seven or eight of them all in their SWAT outfits, standing in front of a library. Maybe it was at Columbia or one of the places. So basically, you're right. What we do abroad, we do at home without any question. Currently, in the federal court in New York, there is a damage suit brought by survivors or the families of victims of a series of bombings that took place in Israel in 2002 and one in 2004. The lawsuit is being brought against the Palestinian Authority and the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and it's for billions of dollars in damages under a special anti-terrorism law passed by the United States. Now, why do I think that this fits into the usual hypocrisy about Palestine and Israel that plays out in this country and in courts through the world? Here's why. First of all, we have to look at the context of that lawsuit. There's an actual trial going on against two Palestinian entities that are part of the Palestinian state. And let's look at what's happened in the last few years. We've had three assaults, major assaults on Gaza. The latest was, of course, Protective Edge, when 2,500 people were killed, the majority of them being civilians, 500 children. Prior to that, we had Cast Lead in 2008, 2009, again, hundreds, thousands killed, and then we had Pillar of Defense. We've had three major military assaults that have violated the laws of war, and yet no Israeli has ever stood trial in any court in the world for that assault. And certainly the Israeli government has not stood trial. And then you have the continuous occupation of Palestinian lands, particularly in the West Bank. Again, violation of the laws of war, the Geneva Conventions, but no court so far has been willing to hear that. And yet here we have this case, bombings that took place in 2002 and 2004, killed, I think, 33 people, injured scores of others. But the question is, first of all, the context in which this kind of case against Israel would never survive in a U.S. court. And secondly, is the Palestinian state really responsible for those bombings that took place and took people's lives? I'm not saying here that the killing of civilians is justified at all, but I'm saying there's unequal justice being applied. First, as I said, because of the context, and secondly, because there is no real proof that the Palestinian Authority or the PLO actually had a policy of killing civilians in the way these people were killed. And in fact, when the Israelis went into Ramallah, which is the capital of the West Bank of the PA, they took thousands of documents around this very period of time. They claim that those documents showed that the Palestinian Authority was involved in setting up these kind of bombings, etc. In fact, Human Rights Watch looked at those documents and said they show nothing of the sort. So we not only have a bad context, but we also don't have any evidence. Third, and this is very important, normally when you sue a state in the United States, another state, if I sue Haiti or France or somewhere else, or a state entity, they have immunity. I'm not allowed to bring those cases. It's called foreign sovereign immunity. You can't bring those cases in U.S. courts. So the question is why, in this case, with the Palestinian Authority and the PLO, which are all part of the entity of the Palestinian state, why is this lawsuit allowed to proceed? Well, here's why. The U.S. doesn't recognize Palestine as a state, despite the fact that 134 countries recognize Palestine as a state, despite the fact that the General Assembly recognizes Palestine as a state, despite the fact that it's able to sign international agreements, including signing up to the International Criminal Court as a state, the U.S. doesn't recognize it as a state, and therefore it refuses to give immunity to the PA and the PLO in this lawsuit. In other words, it's allowing this lawsuit to proceed. It doesn't have to do that. Even if it didn't recognize Palestine as a state, the U.S. could say to the court, we think in this case it's analogous to a state, etc., and it should have immunity. So what we're seeing played out here is another case in which Israel is immune, but Palestine is not. I can give you one example from our own experience at the Center for Constitutional Rights. We brought a case for an act that occurred in the same time period, 2002 or so. It was against Avi Dichter. Avi Dichter was an Israeli general who we said was responsible for dropping a one-ton bomb on a house in Gaza, killing 15 members of a family, 15 civilians. We brought that lawsuit saying this was a war crime. It was disproportional. You can't just kill civilians by dropping a one-ton bomb on a house, etc. Ultimately, in the appeals court, we lost the case. Why did we lose it? Because the Israeli government came in and said what Avi Dichter did was an official act of the Israeli government, and therefore, under U.S. law, he is immune from suit. So there's an exact example. You can't get Avi Dichter, but you can get the PA, the Palestinian Authority, apparently for an act it didn't even do. We'll have to see what happens as this trial plays out and the testimony plays out, but it's just another example of the unfairness of the justice system when it comes to people in the sights of the United States. Let me give a final example here. The United States is joined at the hip with Israel. We supply $3 billion in weapons. I think it was Chomsky who said this is a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Middle East. Imagine this. Imagine in the middle of the height of apartheid, trying the ANC in South Africa. Would that be a fair trial? Imagine in the middle of the French-Algerian War, trying Algerians in France. Would that be fair? Well, that's what we're doing here. We're basically having a justice system that is trying the oppressed in the courts of the oppressor, or certainly in the courts of a country that is tied at the hip to the oppressor, Israel. Heidi, often on this show we refer to the International Criminal Court. That's the court that has essentially universal jurisdiction all over the world to go after war crimes, torture, crimes against humanity, etc. We often say it doesn't do a great job sometimes. After all, it indicted 36 African dictators under Ocampo, the former prosecutor. Now, under the new prosecutor, it may do a bit better. It's looking into Israeli violations of Palestinian rights, etc. But what's amazing to me, this arcane subject of the International Criminal Court, which most people, you know, they probably have never heard of it, or if they have heard of it, they have no idea what really goes on in it, has become the subject of apparently a very interesting TV series, which our host, Heidi Boghossian, watches, sometimes for hours. So, Heidi, what's this about the ICC as a series?
Michael, you would have to see it to believe it. And I was delighted to come across the program called Crossing Lines. Basically, it is about a unit of specialists based in The Hague that investigate different crimes, essentially that cross international boundaries. And in their unit, they have a former NYPD officer, who had an injury and then became addicted to morphine, but has been reborn as sort of the leader of this crew. They have,
what does this crew do?
Well, they have a hacker.
Can you say that again?
What does this crew do?
Well, the crew investigates crimes that occur in at least one country, so that if it's in Italy and Germany, they have like serial killers, for example, then they're called on the scene to investigate. And Donald Sutherland is sort of the boss of them, and he gets to make the case to the court that they should investigate. They have a computer hacker or technical specialist from Germany, a crimes analyst from France, a weapons specialist and tactical expert from Ireland. And the plots are quite interesting, but I think, as you've noted, Michael, they flash their ID cards and say International Criminal Court, and, you know, everyone parts as though it's this really phenomenal entity. But I think it's quite wonderful that it's drawing attention to them.
No, I think it's amazing, and let's hope it gets greater, and that when people actually see something, they may have some fear about that they might wind up in the ICC.
Right.
Let's hope that fear is particularly among Israelis and people who are out of Africa. I mean, Bush, Cheney,
right.
Although the U.S. hasn't joined the court yet, so the court has limited jurisdiction. On the other hand, the U.S. committed torture in Afghanistan, and that's a big subject because something like half of the CIA victims of torture, 150 or 60, were tortured in various sites in Afghanistan, which is a member of the ICC. And therefore, you could bring those CIA people, as well as their bosses, to justice in the ICC.
Michael, I think you should be a consultant on Crossing Lines.
It's good. It could pay for our show here.
That's right.
Pay for my taxi fare to get to the radio station. Today, we're going to bring you an update on the Pelican Bay solitary confinement case. As you may recall, Pelican Bay, a prison in California, had over 1,000 prisoners in long-term solitary confinement. And by long-term, we mean 10 to 20 years or more. The Center for Constitutional Rights and its lead attorney, Jules Lobel, have been challenging this practice for a number of years, since 2012. Recently, in an effort to blunt the lawsuit, the state of California has transferred some of the named plaintiffs to other prisons. Their theory, once we're rid of the named plaintiffs, maybe we're rid of the lawsuit. The center and Jules recently went out to California to argue that this was not a constitutional practice, that transferring a person from solitary at Pelican Bay to another prison in California should not blunt the lawsuit. And in fact, the center said we should be able to challenge solitary practices in those prisons as well. The judge agreed, and now the center's case will not just challenge Pelican Bay's solitary confinement practices, but those in other prisons throughout California. Our guest today is Center for Constitutional Rights President and law professor Jules Lobel, the lead lawyer in this important class action lawsuit. Jules, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Jules, I understand that just recently you made an important argument in a case we've covered a number of times here before, the Pelican Bay solitary confinement case. Can you tell us what's going on in that case? Why were you out in California again? And bring us up to date.
Yeah, because of three hunger strikes and our litigation, the California prison officials are now instituting reforms. They realize they have to do something. And they're going through all these guys, many of them who've been in solitary for over a decade, some over two decades.
Right. Your case, I remember, concerns people from 10 to 28 years in solitary, right?
Exactly. That's our Eighth Amendment claim. We have a due process claim for everybody. There are over 1,000 people in solitary. When we started the case, 500 people were there for over 10 years.
It's unbelievable.
And because of the reforms they've made under pressure from our litigation, they're now only 230. So still 230 people over 10 years is a huge amount. But they're realizing that they've been putting people in solitary who under no circumstances should have been there. I mean, we say that nobody should be in solitary for this amount of time. But even if you say that some people were very dangerous, these weren't very dangerous people. They just were keeping them there because for political reasons or because of racial reasons or things that were not tied to legitimate prison concerns. So they're moving a lot of people out. But they're also moving some people out, not into general population prisons, but into other solitary units in other prisons, other shoes. It's called a special housing unit.
Right, because your case concerns Pelican Bay, though if they move people out, it might hurt the class of people you're bringing the case on behalf of?
Which is why they're doing it. 4 of our 10 plaintiffs, in fact, have been moved to another shoe in a place called Tehachapi, and the defendants say they're no longer part of your case. They have nothing to do with this anymore. As long as they're out of Pelican Bay, you've gotten a remedy.
Let me ask a question, because I think you came in with 10 plaintiffs originally. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yep, and 2 of them are still left at Pelican Bay.
Right, and the way a class, even though this is a class action, the way it works is you have named plaintiffs, and essentially they're trying to destroy the 10 people who are your class members so that they can no longer bring the case. Is that it?
Correct, and they're also not just destroying, you know, the class representatives. When you say destroying, they're not only moving them out so it moots their case, but they've decided to give hearings to everybody who's been over there. It's been in the Pelican Bay for more than 10 years. How did they choose 10 years? Well, it's clearly tied to our lawsuit. It's an attempt to minimize our class. So they're moving not only our named plaintiffs, but other class members into other prisons, but many of them are being moved into prisons that are still in solitary. They haven't gotten out of solitary. They've just been transferred from Pelican Bay to some other location. And we decided a number of months ago, after consulting with our clients, that we had to expand the case to include this move transfer to other prisons, that we couldn't just keep it just at Pelican Bay.
So you mean to say this case is being expanded to include solitary and other prisons?
It is now. And that's, in fact, what that's what the argument was about. The argument was about whether you can expand the case beyond Pelican Bay to transferring people to other prisons. We're not expanding it so much that anybody put into another prison in solitary is now part of our class. But if you were at Pelican Bay and you were transferred to another prison that's still in solitary, you're still part of our class.
So that means you would be challenging people who are in solitary in other prisons.
Correct.
So that whether it includes everybody in that prison or not is not the issue. Once you start challenging the solitary in other prisons, you're essentially challenging the entire system in California.
Exactly. Even if the class is simply this group, the case will set a precedent which will affect all the prisons in California.
What you have to love about it just strikes me, Jules, is that here they have a idea to let's get rid of Jules's or the class members, move them to other prisons, and then you're just stuck with challenging Pelican Bay. And now, through that stratagem, you've been basically, through the court allowing it, to challenge now the prisons in every other part of California.
Exactly. And California said, you can't do that. You can't let the CCR do this because it's going to create more new discovery, new expert testimony. We've spent 3 years already. They say we're going to have to spend another 2 or 3 years investigating the conditions in these other prisons. And that was a real dilemma because, you know, our clients in Pelican Bay want to move ahead. We have a trial date in December of 2015 in 10 months. And we have an interest in getting to trial on that issue. So what we said and what the judge accepted, and that was a key victory we had, which is the judge accepted that we could expand the case, rejecting the state's argument that this is an improper expansion. It's going to take too long. It raises whole new prisons because the judge said, look, you know, you're just saying people who have been kept in solitary can't be kept in solitary in another place. And, of course, it raises the problem of what's unconstitutional solitary, but so what? You know, I can decide that. So the judge agreed with us and allowed us to expand the case to people who were transferred to other prisons.
But let me ask you what this means. You have a trial in 10 months, and I want you to describe briefly, and I know we're going to move along quickly, what the issues are. But will it just then, in the 10-month trial, that'll be Pelican Bay, and then the other prisons' rules on solitary, et cetera, will be in another case?
It won't be in another case, but, yeah, we bifurcated the trial so that we could have a relatively quick trial on Pelican Bay, on raising the fundamental question of Pelican Bay is whether keeping people for a very prolonged period of time in solitary confinement at Pelican Bay is cruel and unusual punishment. And we also have a claim that the way they're placed there, the way they've been placed there and retained there, violates due process. So those are the two issues. So we'll have that trial in December. And then if we win in that trial, the court will then have to decide whether moving them to other prisons continues that constitutional violation or not. And that could go forward relatively quickly. I mean, I think that would take maybe 6 months.
What would be the ideal victory in terms of a judgment in your Pelican Bay case? I mean,
on the Eighth Amendment, and a victory would be for the court, and this would be the first court in the country to recognize squarely that keeping people in a 10-by-8-foot cell with no windows, no phone calls, no physical contact with other people, you know, very limited visiting, very limited recreation, that's cruel and inhuman treatment. And it's prohibited by the Constitution, and you cannot keep people in that condition for a long period of time. And then the question is what relief we would get, and what we've argued and what our clients have argued is that people should be put either into general population. Most people don't need this kind of confinement, that this is unnecessary. But that if they can't be put into general population, if they have to be segregated from the other prisoners because they're too dangerous, they should be segregated but treated humanely. They should be allowed phone calls to home. They should be allowed contact visits with their family and loved ones. They should be allowed some time where they can talk to other people under tight security. But to totally isolate people destroys what is essential to human dignity. That social contact, social interaction is a key part of what makes us human. And you're taking away people's humanity by doing this.
And that's on your Eighth Amendment, which is the cruel treatment. And then you also have what you refer to as a due process claim.
Yeah, we have a claim that the process that they used to put people in and keep people there was meaningless, that they had all these standards which were totally vague, that the investigation was by gang investigators and the decisions were written by the same people who investigated. There was no, you know, separate decision maker. And on that, I think even the California now realizes that the old process was screwed up, and they've moved to change it. So I think we're in good shape on winning on that. Then the question is the new process constitutional? And we probably won't reach that question until after this case is over, you know, because this case wasn't about the reform process. It's about the process they were using when we brought the case.
So between now and the trial in 10 months, what do you expect in terms of any developments? I know you're in discovery preparing for trial. Do you expect any more court hearings?
We're going to move for, both we and probably the state, will move for summary judgment in July, and there'll be a major court hearing in September.
What does summary judgment mean?
Summary judgment means that even assuming the facts as defendants say they are, the facts are, they still should, it's still a violation. So I don't think there's any real dispute as to the facts about the process that they use. So that is an issue that is ripe for summary judgment. For example, these guys only get reviews every 6 years. So you stay in your cell for 6 years, and then after 6 years, somebody comes and reviews whether you should be kept in solitary. 6 years is an unbelievably long period of time. No state in the country has a six-year period. I mean, usually it's 30 days, 90 days, 6 months, maybe at most a year. But California used 6 years, and we think that on its face, that's unconstitutional. Another question that might be appropriate for summary judgment is California, unlike most states, puts people into solitary simply because they are a member of a gang or they're associated with a gang. And we're going to have experts who say that the modern trend in prison management is not to put people in solitary unless they've done something violent. You know, somebody murders somebody or assaults somebody, then you put them in solitary. Their name is found on a membership list of a gang. You shouldn't put them in solitary just for that. Or they have a gang tattoo. Shouldn't be in solitary just for that. And I think that's an issue that might be appropriate for a summary judgment motion.
Well, Jules, thank you very much. I know you're off to teach your next class, but it's been an amazingly interesting and important case. It's really the only major case in the country taking on what most people in much of the, quote, civilized world believe is an inhuman practice. So thank you, and we'll look forward to the next update.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Conflict between licensed professionals who assist in practices that violate human rights, such as physicians assisting with torture, also exists with licensed architects who design prisons, solitary confinement cells, and death chambers. Recently, the American Institute of Architects rejected a petition to censure members who designed such units. Raphael Sperry, president of the Organization of Architects, Designers, and Planners for Social Responsibility, proposed adopting a rule similar to the American Medical Association's, which prohibits doctors from participating in execution or in torture. Raphael joins us today to talk about the details of the proposed code of ethics and an architect's responsibility. Raphael Sperry, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
On this show, we've covered the issue of psychologists and healthcare professionals who have aided in the process of torture, and we've talked about the professional duty in cases such as that. So we were surprised pleasantly to learn of your effort to have the American Institute of Architects censure members, architects who design solitary confinement cells and death chambers. I understand that you've spearheaded this effort. How did you come to bring the petition that you brought before the AIA?
Well, the petition is sponsored by the organization that I lead, which is Architects, Designers, and Planners for Social Responsibility. And we've been concerned about conditions in American prisons and the kind of facts of mass incarceration for more than 10 years. And in 2013, when the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture announced that spending more than 15 days in solitary confinement was a human rights violation, and we were aware that people in the United States are routinely held in solitary for years, if not decades, and that there had been dozens of supermax prisons that housed thousands of people in those conditions, specially designed just for that purpose, that really tipped the scales. That, and also seeing the execution chamber rebuild that the state of California did at the San Quentin State Prison there, for which when they finished the project, they actually published the computer model for the design. And that was really shocking to realize that the same tools that architects use every day trying to make the world a better place for people can be used to torture and kill people.
Well, let me ask you this. Are bids put out by prisons when they need architects to design these chambers and units?
Well, certainly for larger facilities like a solitary confinement unit, a supermax prison, absolutely. That they go to the private market and they solicit bids like state governments do for all sorts of jobs.
I'm interested in how do people know these are for solitary? I mean, when architects design them, are they very different than other cells? Are they said these are for solitary, or do you just know it?
Well, you know, the question of what constitutes, say, a torture chamber is complicated. There's many buildings that have been used to house prisoners in solitary that were never designed for that purpose. And in that kind of instance, there's no way I, or I don't think anybody else, would try and hold the designer responsible for the outcome there. But there are a subset of prisons that are intended for prolonged solitary confinement. They're usually called, in prison speak, administrative segregation units or security housing units. Supermax prisons are the most egregious, I suppose. And in those, there's no space for people to eat together. There's no tables, with seats clustered around them even. The recreation spaces that prisoners have their right to go into for, an hour a day are shrunk down to the size where they're for just one person. So there's a lot of design details that you can look at and realize that the place is actually intended for solitary confinement.
I understand that with certain public accommodations and spaces, they're sort of, minimum number of feet, for example, that you have to have in a hallway. What you've just described makes me wonder if in designing a solitary confinement unit, they necessarily violate some of the sort of tenets of architecture in terms of proportionality in how space is used.
They don't. I wouldn't say. There's certainly the building code, which is mostly the space kind of dimensions you're talking about are supposed to provide for life safety, especially in case of a fire. And prisons are a complicated case because you can't allow people to leave the building, even if there's a dangerous fire. But there are other ways to kind of try and provide an equivalent level of safety to what you get in other kinds of buildings. And that illustrates some of the general problem of prisons, but that's not unique to solitary confinement. What you see with the solitary buildings is that prisoner rights lawsuits from the 70s established kind of de facto minimum standards that aren't in the building code, and architects don't usually read the case law, so they usually kind of come to it through, say, the standards of the American Correctional Association, and then they make those rooms generally like 1 inch bigger than what courts said was constitutionally unacceptable.
I have a question going back to what constitutes a solitary cell. You talked particularly around what happens outside the cell, communal eating, exercise, etc. What about in the cell? Is there some special way that architects look at what happens in the cell?
Like, are they not allowed to have windows? There's a toilet there?
I've seen different kind of configurations, and in some ways, the cells that are for supermax are not that different from cells that I've often seen designed for maximum security housing. Some of them are a little different. You guys are probably familiar with the ADX prison in
yes.
Florence, the federal supermax, which is supposed to be the most secure and the most supermax in the United States. In that facility, they actually have showers in every cell, which is a very expensive way to build a prison. They usually try and avoid that. But what that allows them to do is actually not provide, the prisoners then don't have to get into the hallway where they might walk by somebody else's cell or be escorted by a guard to get to a shower.
So it's really, when we're talking about solitary in one way, it's about what's in the cell, but it's really about the fact there's no way to do anything outside the cell. There's no social communication. There's no exercise.
Right. And I mean, of course, you could take a prison that had all those things and never let anybody out in a permanent lockdown. And again, that would not be the architect's fault. But when you've got a place like ADX or Pelican Bay in California, you can't let the prisoners out after the fact. Like there is some design responsibility because there's nowhere for them to go and there's nowhere for them to safely be together. And that was actually a very intentional decision, and it's not the kind of decision we should be making if we're interested in rehabilitating prisoners or even recognizing their basic human rights.
Raphael, tell us about the specifics in your petition. You called on the American Institute of Architects to censure members who designed these units. And what happened?
So the AIA has a code of ethics for members. And it already has a statement that says members should uphold human rights in all their professional responsibilities, which is actually a terrific phrase, and I'm really glad that it's in there. It's not directly enforceable. There are rules associated with these kind of higher-level standards like that, and there's only one rule about human rights, which is about non-discrimination, which, again, is a good rule, but if members set out to design a space intended to kill somebody or to torture them or degrade them, which is a human rights violation, AIA is not prepared to take any disciplinary action against a member who does that. We were asking them to simply add a rule that clarified, if a member designs a space that is intended for human rights violations, specifically execution and prolonged solitary confinement, that then it would be clear they were in violation of the Code of Ethics, and then AIA could take disciplinary action, which could include censure, could include expelling them from the Institute.
And what was the reaction to it? I mean, within, first, you have an organization, Architects, Designers, Planners, which I assume is obviously behind this.
But how
big is this American Institute of Architects, which I think is very well known? I think every plan that you ever see has AIA on it. What was the reaction within the AIA?
Well, the reaction was mixed. Before we, ADPSR, we took the this proposal to a number of chapters, which is where most members participate in the Institute, and we got strong letters of endorsement from the San Francisco chapter, where most of our members live, or at least the largest clump of them. We also got a great endorsement from the Boston chapter. We had an endorsement from the chapter in Portland, Oregon. But then, for instance, in New York City, it was very disappointing that the local chapter there actually, they referred the question to the group of architects within that chapter who designed prisons, who didn't like the idea.
That's amazing.
I think there's a lot for them. If they want to go to their clients and say, we'd like to design this ethically, you know, they don't have a leg to stand on right now when their client says, I'm not interested. But anyway, they didn't see it that way. They preferred a business-friendly approach. New York is AI's biggest chapter, so that was a very discouraging response. The National Board of Directors gets to set the ethics code for the whole organization, including all the chapters. They took in our petition. They took in the letters of support that we sent in. Then they never communicated with us. They refused to, they didn't have any questions about anything. They referred it to an internal group. They never let us or anybody know who was on that panel. They came up with some kind of recommendation. They discussed it in an executive session, so there's no transparency into what the board thought. And then they sent a brief letter back to me for, you know, as the representative of ADPSR, saying that they weren't going to make the change and that they were concerned about potential antitrust violations, how hard it would be to enforce, which are both really silly objections. But I think the bigger issues they raised were that they're worried that people could ask to ban other kinds of buildings, which I don't think is a realistic objection, but I understand why they said that. And then lastly, that they don't want to restrict their members from designing any particular building type. And I just found that to be the worst, because that there's no limit to what members can do, and that our profession has no obligation to ethics in the sphere of architecture. Their ethics code is mostly about business practice. If you're going to be a professional and take on the responsibility of protecting public health, safety, and welfare every time you put your pencil down, then there should be limits to what you do with that specialized knowledge.
I'd like to talk about death chambers for a minute. We all see in the movies a room with a window and a small audience that watches. How similar is that scenario to the actual chambers where executions take place?
Well, I've certainly seen a number. I'm not sure which movie you're talking about, but the pictures you see in the paper are the actual places where executions occur. And there are these relatively small, usually interior rooms with a gurney in the middle. And yeah, windows surrounding them so that different categories of the public and people related to the crime can observe the event. And usually adjacent to that, there's actually a control room, as it's called, which you don't see, in which they station the people who are going to inject the lethal chemicals.
Does each prison have one of these, or is it limited to just a few correctional facilities?
Oh, there are very few execution chambers within the United States, relatively speaking. Each of the states that has a death penalty tends to have one or sometimes two, because they would have a second one for women. And the federal government has a couple, because the military justice system has like a parallel set to the civilian justice system.
Well, I mean, solitary, as you well know, has been just growing and growing, and maybe now it's getting more public attention. We'll see what happens with Pelican Bay and some other lawsuits that are going on. But the death penalty has not been growing, and I can't imagine there's been a lot of death chambers built in the last decade. So it's hard for me to understand why the AIA would have at least said, okay, well, solitary is one thing, but death chambers? But there was no distinction they made, I assume.
Well, we were asking them to consider both
right. At
the same time, because we feel that, to us, it's not exactly a political issue. It's a human rights issue. And they said they're an organization that's for human rights. And the human rights interpretations on solitary and executions are equally strong. So So it didn't seem to us like they should pick and choose which human rights violations they're okay with and which ones they're going to restrict. But I understand that a lot of people within the profession, within the United States, see it as a political issue. And I think you're right that the politics of the death penalty are becoming less popular, and the politics of solitary confinement are not well understood, not nearly as much of a national issue. So yeah, politically, they probably would have been more comfortable there. Frankly, you know, the people who considered this may not have even come up with the idea of splitting it in half and approving half that everybody would be comfortable with.
Yeah, I'm not saying it should be, because, I mean, you know, we at the center are doing the Pelican Bay lawsuit. And in fact, I'm sure you've looked at this. When we went over to Europe, the number of people in solitary are like three or four in all of England, for example, in the UK. I mean, it's like not used. It's considered inhuman. So, you know, the fact that we have tens of thousands, if not more, in solitary is extraordinary.
Tell us briefly about the licensure process for architects. So just like the law and medicine, architects require a license, and that means that they have sort of a monopoly, I guess, over the practice. How does that protect the public? Does it ensure the integrity of structures that are built?
That's such a great question, because that really does get at this from an important angle for my organization and also for the American Institute of Architects. Architectural licensing is given by the states on the premise that architects protect public health, safety, and welfare in our work, which is actually a key legal phrase for, you know, when there's ever, say, claims of negligence against architects and so on. And yeah, it's supposed to provide an extra level of protection. The building industry is very complicated. It's very fragmented. There are a lot of different players. There's a lot of pressure to keep costs down, inevitably. The public has building inspectors, but they're not as highly trained as architects, and they're not able to be involved in the process in a detailed way, whereas the architect is supposed to function on the job site, not just as the agent of the owner who commissioned the building and, you know, commit to, because we come up with the plans that realize here's, you know, where the spaces are supposed to be, how big they are, what materials to use. But we're also supposed to, one of our roles, maintain quality and ensure that the contractor is actually building what was contracted for the owner's rights, but also to make sure that nobody's cutting corners that would put the public at risk. Exactly so. And so saying, well, all of our buildings are safe, when you know that when a licensed architect designed this building and you walked into it, it was thought of with your health, safety, and welfare in mind, that's what our profession is about. So it just seems outrageous, but here we are designing this small group of structures where the point is, we know that when you go into it, you're going to get killed or you're going to get tortured, and that we would actually do that. It's just totally contradictory to our professional ethic and the basis of licensure as well.
This makes so much sense to us. How did the idea first come to you to bring this petition to censure members who are involved in the design?
Well, we had run an earlier petition, actually, back in 2003 and 2004, urging members of the profession in general to boycott the design of additional prisons and jails, because the United States has an incarceration rate that's just so much higher than the rest of the world and really out of proportion to any reasonable public policy of crime control or public safety. It's just, you know, I'm sure you know a lot about that. And so when we became aware of prison issues, we wanted to challenge them that way. So we were already kind of thinking about that. Again, it was when the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture said that solitary confinement was a human rights violation that we connected that to the existing part of the AIA's code that says that members should uphold human rights. And we thought, this is important. If members should uphold human rights, execution chambers have always been troubling to us. But then we said, now we're recognizing that the spaces that have been designed that are holding tens of thousands of people are, you know, degrading them in an internationally unacceptable way, and we really have to stop that. It seemed like there was a better hook, because
right,
they already had committed to human rights, and we wanted to support them in that, as it were.
And I want to note, I read that in 1993, the American Institute of Architects actually gave your group, Architects, Designers, Planners for Social Responsibility, an award, calling you, quote, a strong, resounding voice for social and political justice. What are you going to do now?
Well, I think this issue is far from over.
I
Human
agree.
Rights will always be there for AIA. And over the years, their board members are actually elected every 3 years. So a third of the board will be new this year. 3 years from now, there'll be an entirely new board of directors who might see things differently. I think we have more education to do, though. I think that, in a sense, the fact that the board took the position it did reflects the interests of some members who don't understand the human rights issues around solitary confinement. And so I think that we have the opportunity and perhaps a bit of responsibility to try harder to reach more people. I think the fact that AIA rejected the proposal the first time around has really helped to increase the amount of debate and awareness of the issue. So it's unfortunate that when you go to somebody the first time with a good idea, that's the right idea, the right thing to do, and isn't going to cost them anything, they won't do it because they're afraid. And I think in the long run, they can come around just like many people have come around on human rights.
Right. And do you and others speak about this issue publicly?
I personally have given many talks about it publicly on behalf of ADPSR. The most recent one was in Washington, D.C. just a couple of weeks ago. We have other board members around the country, and I've been in touch now with a couple of members of AIA's National Ethics Council who are actually very concerned about what the board did. And so I think there's a lot of people who want to talk about it in their chapter and other organizations.
Do you have a website our listeners can go to if they want to read about this?
Probably the best place to go is ADPSR.org, which is Architects, Designers, and Planners for Social Responsibility.
Raphael, we'd love to stay in touch with you as you continue your efforts to raise attention on this important issue. And we want to thank you so much for what you've done and for bringing this to the fore.
It's an honor to speak with you both, and thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks.
Thank you, Raphael. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. Sitting here in limbo, waiting for the dice to roll. Sitting here in limbo, got some time to search my soul. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. I don't know where life will lead me, but I know. Show me what I know, what I've seen. Tried my hand at love and friendship, but all that is past and gone. This little boy is moving on. Sitting here in limbo, waiting for the tide to flow. Sitting here in limbo, knowing that I have to go. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my fate will lead me on. I can't say.